Blog Talk Radio.
Does not get taxed by the U.S. government until it flows back to the parent company.
A J.P. Morgan report estimates that $1.7 trillion in foreign earnings is being held overseas by more than 1,000 U.S. firms yet to be taxed by the federal government. And meanwhile, back in Washington, hundreds of corporate lobbyists are pushing for ever more lower corporate tax rates or for elimination of all taxes on overseas corporate income, which would make the problem worse.
These proposals raise the question of whether the interests of multinational corporations are fundamentally different from the interests of American workers. As Yang points out, the interests of U.S. multinationals appear less neatly tethered to the interests of this country. When you get U.S. businesses coming to Washington and talking about, "We need to do this and that for the U.S. economy," what does that even mean? Said Doug Shackelford, a professor of taxes at the University of North Carolina's Kenan Flagner Business School. Who are they referring to? Is it U.S. workers? Is it U.S. shareholders? The AFL-CIO is urging Congress to eliminate the tax benefit of sending jobs overseas and shifting income to tax havens. The way to do that is to tax overseas corporate income the same as domestic corporate income, which would generate $583 billion over 10 years. This money could be used to invest in infrastructure, clean energy, and education to put America back to work.
That doesn't make sense, $583 billion, when they're talking $1.7
trillion. Okay. I don't know. Over 10 years?
Huh?
And that's over 10 years?
Yeah.
I don't know. But maybe seeing what's happening in Europe right now, how money is being taken from overseas tax accounts and tax haven and these tax haven accounts.
Yeah, but
maybe they'll be a little.
That isn't going to be,
well, people are a little nervous. It could be happening in other countries.
Yeah.
Who knows? If the bankers get away with it there.
Well, the bankers are getting away with everything everywhere, and that's what's the problem. I mean, we're just stupid, to take it. And hang on a second. State cuts don't spur economic growth.
State tax cuts don't spur economic growth. Now that's interesting. Let's see why that is. A new study from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities shows states that cut tax rates do worse in terms of economic growth than other states. Numerous Republican governors have pushed for tax cuts under the premise that lower tax rates lead to greater economic growth. But the CBPP study concludes that this premise is wrong. The five states that implemented deep tax cuts during the 1990s experienced slower job growth over the next economic cycle than the states that did not. And none of those states experienced income growth that exceeded inflation. The five states that cut taxes the most in the mid and late 1990s saw job growth of less than 0.3% from 2000 and 2007, while the remaining states averaged a 1% growth. Similarly, the states with the biggest tax cuts saw slower economic growth than other states on average. At least seven Republican-led states are currently pursuing massive tax cuts. I wonder which states those are.
I don't know.
They didn't name them.
I'd be interested.
I would suggest that he mention the states in the article. It would have been more meaningful to me.
Yeah. Not much of a writer. Let's go to this here. Come on. I'm coaxing my computer here to move faster. Let's see. There's something I don't really. Here we go. AFT and Gates Foundation provide principles for teacher evaluation. That's really smart. I can see Gates doing that. The AFT and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which sponsor eugenics, have been working on finding a better way to evaluate and develop teachers, using research to determine the best ways to train teachers and ensure that students get the best educational experience possible. Although the AFD and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation don't always agree on everything, they share the firm belief that every student has the right to access effective instruction, and teachers want to do their very best in the classroom. I don't know why I'm bothering to read this, but let's see. Vicki Phillips of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and AFT President Randy Weingarten say in the New Republic article, "We believe that one of the most effective ways to strengthen both teaching and learning is to put in place evaluation systems that are not just a stamp of approval or disapproval, but a means of improvement. We also agree that in too many places, teacher evaluation procedures are broken, unconstructed, superficial, or otherwise inadequate. And so for the past 4 years, we have worked together to help states and districts implement effective teacher development and evaluation systems carefully designed to improve teacher practice and ultimately student learning. And the research that conducted reveals that the most important factor schools are affecting student performance is teacher quality. In fact, effective teaching is a complex alchemy requiring command subjects and blah, 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 blah." You know, this is such bullshit, and I'll tell you why. All right, the reason is that 99% of the problems in the school systems are the parents and the kids themselves, okay? Teachers can't discipline these kids if they're half of them are sleeping because they're not getting their sleep, or they're drugged out, or their parents are aren't anywhere to be found. Okay,
teachers get blamed for a lot of things that they don't have control over.
They have no control
but
over.
Also, the other thing that's affecting kids right now is that so many kids are living in poverty.
Yeah,
and so many families are under economic stress. That economic stress trickles down to the children.
I mean, Lila is an expert in this, only because she's a school counselor, an elementary school counselor, and she sees the problems daily. And, I work in the system, too, as a teacher, and this is like...
Well, you're a substitute.
Well, as a substitute teacher, but I still see the crap, and I still see the kids, and I still understand the problems that are faced. And it's not always the teacher at all. Maybe it's...
Sometimes.
10%.
Yeah, right? But not...
But the other 90% is... the problems that are there.
The problems that poverty and unemployment bring.
The problems that Bill Gates himself loves to create, because he is a major eugenicist. I mean, he loves to destroy things, loves to destroy them, right? And right now, his $100 billion foundation could do a hell of a lot more good than it is right now, okay? If he gave away half of that to starving American kids, it would probably bring imagine what $50 billion could do, okay? I saw a study that said $253 billion right now could end world poverty.
That'd be wonderful.
It would feed the world, all right? $253 billion. Pretty much for long. It would set up things that food, crops, and everything else for it. But that ain't gonna happen. So that we're stuck with this. There's a couple of things. Bill Gates is an overrated schmuck, in my book. And everything that he does is questionable.
Well, even they said they don't agree with him in lots of ways.
And his reasons for doing things are not always
You wonder what's behind it.
Exactly. This is interesting, and only in the sense that we're my upcoming guest in the next month is the head of the Mexican Miners Union. Throughout the country, and so is his father, and all the problems that they've had over time. and he talks about his book. But not quite 3 years ago, 29 coal miners died in an explosion in West Virginia mine with a history of deliberate safety violations, and a corporate CEO who put running coal over miner safety. Yet, says Representative George Miller, Democrat of California, since the Upper Big Branch tragedy, Congress hasn't been able to do anything to fix our laws so that rogue operators are deterred from operating outside the margins of safety. It piles tragedy upon tragedy if these families have to wait until the next deadly event for Congress to act.
Last week, Miller and Representative Nick Joe Rahal, Democrat, West Virginia, introduced legislation to bring the nation's mine health and safety laws up to date, give mine safety officials the ability to effectively investigate and shut down habitually dangerous mines, and hold mine operators accountable for putting their workers in unnecessary danger, says Rahal. While no piece of legislation can remove all of the dangers inherent in coal mining, we have a responsibility to advance sensible improvements in our national mine health and safety program that we know can save lives. The bill, the Robert C. Byrd Mine Safety Protection Act of 2013, built on provisions from the 2010 measure introduced shortly after the Upper Big Branch disaster, which was blocked by the Republican-controlled House. Now, provisions in the legislation being introduced today would require mine operators to record and maintain records of rock dust purchases so that the Mine Safety and Health Administration can verify steps taken by operators to prevent buildup of explosive coal dust, a key factor at Upper Big Branch. Civil penalties for targeted violations that are known to have contributed to previous mine tragedies are increased, and protections are expanded for whistleblowers who report safety violations to MSHA. It also expands subpoena powers of MSHA so that the agency, like the state of West Virginia, could more thoroughly conduct investigations into mine accidents, strengthen penalties against those who would give advance notice of mine safety inspections, increase the amount of rock dust to 80% of total incombustible content in all working areas.
Late last month in federal court, the former president of the Massey Energy subsidiary, who also served for 20 years in top positions throughout Massey, implicated former Massey CEO Donald Blankenship in a long-term scheme to hide mine safety violations from federal inspectors at mines throughout the Massey system. David Hughart, former president of White Buck Coal Company, pleaded guilty to conspiring with other company officials from 2000 to 2010 to warn of inspections that could let miners and managers conceal potentially deadly conditions that would lead to a shutdown of production. At the hearing, the Associated Press reported, we asked by Judge Ironberger if such warnings were company policy, and I said so. Who ordered it? Hughart said, the chief executive officer. Though he was not mentioned by name in court, Don Blankenship was Massey CAO at the time. And outside the courtroom, Karen Hughart confirmed that that's who her husband meant.
Hughart will be sentenced in June. Former Upper Branch Security Chief Huey Eilbert Stuver was convicted in October of 2011, obstructing justice, lying to the FBI and MSHA agents investigating the mine explosion. He was sentenced to 36 months in prison. Also, former Upper Big Branch Mine Superintendent Gary May was sentenced to 21 months in prison in January, pleading guilty to evading federal mine safety and laws and covering up safety violations.
And see, this is one reason I was hoping that Ashley Judd would run for Senate against Mitch McConnell, because Mitch McConnell is a sellout, just sold out to all. I mean, in Kentucky, sold out to all the big
mining
and mining concerns.
Yeah.
You know, and he's the Republican minority leader, but you know his. You know, there's. I think we read this on the air not too long ago, that I think his net assets when he started in the Senate were, his own net assets were like $3 million. And to this day, his assets are over $29 million.
Yeah, I guess he made a few money.
I think $59 million.
He made a few pennies in there, huh?
Yeah, and all from, you know, wheeling and dealing in Congress, you know, and backing these huge conglomerates, coal mining conglomerates, energy conglomerates. So that's why I wanted to mention that. And let's see, in 1 second.
Maybe have one more to read before we go over to the to another site.
$7.25
an hour, beans and oatmeal.
But minimum wage.
Yeah.
Okay. After President Obama called for raising the nation's minimum wage to $9 an hour, protecting against inflation, the struggle that millions of lower wage workers face trying to survive on the current $7.25 an hour federal minimum wage is back on the nation's radar screen.
Recently, NBC News took a look at the workers who answer your customer service calls, deliver your pizzas, take care of your children, bag your groceries, and serve your food, including Crystal DuPont, 25, who takes customer service calls in the Houston apartment she shares with her mother, who has disability. Writes NBC Lynn, Allison Lynn, DuPont has no health insurance, so she hasn't seen a doctor in 2 years. She's behind on her car payments and has taken out pawn shop and payday loans to cover monthly expenses. She eats beans and oatmeal when her food budget gets low. When she got her tax refund recently, she used the money to get ahead on her light bill. I try to live within my means, but sometimes you just can't, said DuPont. Thanks to Portside, where you can read the full story, for passing this along. In other minimum wage news, San Jose, California recently increased its minimum wage to $10 an hour. Representative George Miller, Democrat, California, and Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat, Iowa, have introduced legislation to increase the federal minimum wage to $10.10. And a new report reveals that the American Legislative Exchange Council is engaged in a widespread campaign to weaken or repeal state minimum wage laws and other low-wage worker protections.
Yeah.
Nice.
Anyway, that's.
I never heard of that, the American Legislative Exchange. I don't even know what that is. A report reveals that the American Legislative Exchange is in a widespread campaign. I never heard of the American Legislative Exchange.
Exchange Council.
Yeah.
No.
Is it another PAC or one of those things?
We have now.
And who's behind that? The Koch brothers?
I have no idea.
They're behind everything.
A new report reveals the American Legislative Exchange Council is engaged in a widespread campaign to weaken and repeal.
Yeah, I never heard of that group. What does it say right here from NBC?
I don't care.
Minimum wage. Well, it's something on minimum wage.
That's that woman there, that 25-year-old.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
Customer service job.
Well, why don't we go to a little music break while we bring up our other site?
Yeah.
So why don't you do that right now?
I'm going to do that. Yes, I will.
So while Leo's going to a music break, we'll bring up our other site and take a look at. don't know. This
I
might be a good little audio.
This is a journalist bashing. It won't take no for an answer from a sleazy, evasive banker crushing the lives of millions.
But wouldn't it be nice to have something like this on the mainstream media? Let's hope we can get it. Sometimes they take these things down.
Yeah, they take them right down.
It's very good. I'm impressed by the depth of the discussion in Ireland and the understanding of complex economic financial sector issues, which is revealed by looking into the Irish press, looking into the discussion, but also when I come from the airport with a taxi driver, they are often very well informed, I must say, very well informed. So I think that is a good sign that here we have an open discussion. It's a difficult adjustment process, but there is an open debate, and there's a debate where economic arguments play an important role, and I think that is how it should be.
Klaus, Manish, did your taxi driver tell you how the Irish people are bewildered that we are required to pay unguaranteed bondholders billions of euros for debts that the Irish people have no relation to or no bearing with, primarily to bail out or to ensure the solvency of European banks? And if your taxi driver asked you that question, or if the taxi driver had asked you that question, what would have been your response? That's my first question.
Can we take a couple together? Can you ask the second question?
Well, my second question is a completely different issue, and
okay.
I may have a follow-through if Mr. Masters doesn't answer the question in a way that would illuminate the taxi driver's understanding of all this. I would have a follow-through question.
Right. Can I ask you then to pass the mic, and we come back to you for the second question?
Yeah, well, if you don't mind, that's a way of breaking up the exchange, and I would prefer if it went this way. We have a tradition in Irish journalism that we pursue issues, and that when somebody doesn't ask a question, we follow through on it. And I hope that tradition will be respected on this occasion. So could you answer the question?
Yeah.
Vincent, I have answered a very similar question of you. I think it was two reviews ago. Again,
You addressed the question. Yes.
I answered it. I would say I can understand that this is a difficult decision to be made by the government, and there's no doubt about it. But there are different aspects of the problem to be balanced against each other, and I can understand that the government came to the view that all in all the costs for the Irish people, for the stability of the banking system, for the confidence in the banking system, of taking certain action in this respect, which you were mentioning, could likely have been much bigger than the benefits for the taxpayer, which of course would have been there. So the financial sector would have been affected, the confidence of the financial sector would have been negatively affected, and I can understand that there was a difficult decision, but that the decision was taken in this direction.
That doesn't address the issue. We are required to pay in respect of a defunct bank. There's no bearing on the welfare of the Irish people at all. We're required to pay in respect of this defunct bank billions on unguaranteed bonds in order to ensure the health of European banks. Now, how would you explain that situation to the taxi driver that you talked about earlier?
I think I have addressed the question.
No, you haven't addressed the question because you've referred to the viability of the Irish financial institutions. This financial institution I'm talking about is defunct. It's over. It's finished. Now, why are the Irish people required, under threat from the ECB, why are the Irish people required to pay billions to unguaranteed bondholders under threat of the ECB? You didn't answer the question the last time, so maybe you'd answer it this time.
Well, I think he doesn't have anything to add to what he's already said.
This isn't good enough. You people are intervening in this society, causing huge damage. by requiring us to make payments, not for the benefit of anybody in Ireland, but for the benefit of European financial institutions. Now, could you explain why the Irish people are inflicted with this burden?
Well, I think I have a good question.
You have nothing to say. There's no answer. Is that right? Is that it? No answer?
I have given an answer.
You have given an answer that doesn't address the question.
That's your view.
That is my view, and I think it would be the view of the taxi driver and the view of our viewers tonight.
Right. Can we please move on?
No, they can't. They can't. It's just like you say, why do they bail out our banks? We have nothing to do.
Well, we sent all the money to Europe. Germany.
Why did we spend? Why did we send over $3 trillion to bail those guys out of our money? All right. I mean, it's like the whole business makes absolutely no sense.
Well,
and those bastards cannot, under any circumstances, explain it to you.
Germany's conquered the world.
Well,
financially,
economic
union.
It's the Rothschild banking system,
Lila.
The Germans.
They're collecting the money for it all.
Yeah, pretty much.
They're the bad men, aren't they?
It's all going
there.
But it's like, you know, the whole system is just sick, and we're getting screwed, rude, and tattooed, you know, and just sitting there.
Well, whatever you do, don't send your money to a tax haven. You're gonna lose it.
No, you won't. Just don't send it to Cyprus.
Well, there'll be other tax havens, but
they're not cutting anybody yet. So, Cayman Islands are still pretty strong.
We'll see.
This bothered me. This particular video bothered me a lot because there's I don't know what your bend is on guns, all right, but and on the government policy toward guns now, but. A weapons manufacturer who supplies the federal government with ammunition told a nationally syndicated Savage Nation radio show that the Department of Homeland Security's huge ammo purchases were an attempt to dry up supplies as part of an end run around the Second Amendment. All right? And we have a little video here, okay, about it.
Right there.
I can actually read part of this article because it was decent. But the it really does explain what they're trying to do. They can't stop selling new guns, but they can buy up billions and billions of rounds of ammo, you know,
Why don't you play that? This is about 7 minutes long.
Michael Savage show. Not that I agree with Michael Savage, but, you know, on anything he says, but...
But maybe let's see what this piece...
But this piece might be... This thing's a little more interesting.
Give me line three, guys. I meant line three. Give me line three. Go ahead. Thomas, you're up. Go ahead, please.
Go. How are you? Hey, I'm a defense contractor, and I'm a licensed weapons manufacturer, so I understand both sides of this. What Homeland Security is doing here... is they're issuing a contract to buy up to that amount of ammo if they want it. They're probably not going to buy it, but by issuing a contract, and they're going to issue this contract to more than one ammo maker. The lady from New Mexico was correct. It's a way to control the amount of market that's available on the commercial market at any time. If they go to the ammo manufacturers and say, give me 50 million rounds, give me another 30 million rounds. If they periodically do this in increments, they're going to control how much ammo is available on the commercial market. As part of their contract, it stipulates in there that when the government calls and says, give us another quantity, that everything they make has to go to the government priority one before any of it goes to the commercial market. So when they get tough or they get nervous, all they have to do is use that contract that they have in place for 1.6 billion rounds, and they just say, give us some more. And
now, Thomas, you're a weapons manufacturer. You supply the government. I'm surprised you even called my show. Has this Well, look, we're getting reports that ammo prices have gone up 100% over the last few months since these huge orders have been put in place. Is that what you're seeing out there in the real world?
Well, yes and no. I want to say the gun show gougers, the guys on the secondary market, whoever has it, yes, it's supply and demand. The ammo, the prices are going way up. The legitimate sources for industry and the real channels, the prices have gone up a little bit, but it's just not available. The legitimate sources and the guys who deal it, the prices are staying about the same, but it's all back-ordered. In fact, the ATF and the State Department, they're kind of jerking around with the importation of it, too. So they're making it difficult for it to come in from overseas. Because right now, all of the domestic manufacturers are running at full speed. They're running three shifts a day. They're cranking it out as fast as they can. Supply cannot keep up with demand.
Thomas, where do you get all the brass from? Where do you get all the lead from? Where do you get all the powder from?
That was going to be my next point. Very few companies who make ammo really do make all of their own components that go into it. The big guys, Olin Corporation that owns Winchester, Alliant Tech Systems that owns Federal, et cetera, these are the big guys, and they really can do their own stuff. They'll source the capital goods, the brass, from both imported and domestic sources, make the primers and the projectiles, the lead. They'll get it in different sources, and they'll smelt it themselves. They really can do it all.
Well, wait, hold on. This is an important amateur question. Isn't there a finite amount of brass, lead, and powder available?
There is. You know, those sources of capital goods you can find out there, but you're right. There's only so many guys.
You see, I touched on this subject last night on my show where I said that there is a finite limit to our economy, and it's a false notion to think that we can continuously expand our economy and that we can continuously expand the job market. It's a false notion. I believe, by the way, this country's maxed itself out given our natural resources. Incidentally, it's a topic for another time. But, you know, that rule applies to everything on Earth. There's also a finite amount of raw material for making bullets on the planet, aren't there?
That's correct. It's a win.
I think we're going to order this meeting. But the reason I brought it up was because that's what's happening. The government is optioning and buying up all the bullets.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So, you know, what's out there is sky high if it's available at all. And the caller noted how this process has caused prices to shoot up in gun shows. And
well, in the commercial market, ammunition was very limited and on back order as a result, and that supply cannot. I lost my place. And that supply cannot keep up with demand. He also noted how the State Department and the AFT were making it harder to import ammunition for overseas.
Now, why would they need to purchase 1.6 billion bullets?
Over the past year,
right?
Well, because they're trying to.
They're trying to stop the munitions flow, you know.
The weapons manufacturer agreed, adding that the deals the DHS is agreeing with manufacturers are based on indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, allowing the feds to monopolize supply on ammo by preventing companies from selling the bush bullets to the commercial market. Savage tied the bullet demand to huge number of new gun purchases since Obama took office, noting people are afraid of him. He's the most frightening American president in modern American history. So people are rushing out to buy guns to protect themselves. But what does a gun need? A gun needs a bullet. Adding that the government is trying to enact gun control via the back door because the Second Amendment says nothing about the right to buy ammunition.
The DHS... huge bullet buys, although erroneously dismissed by some as routine, have exacerbated the nationwide shortage of ammunition. With police departments now so desperate for ammo, they are being forced to barter with each other to meet their needs. In a letter sent to Department of Homeland Security, California Congressman Doug LaMaffa and 14 of his colleagues asked if the bulk bullet purchase were purchases were being conducted in a manner that strategically denies the American people access to ammunition. The DHS subsequently denied that charge, claiming the bullets were being bought in bulk to save money and were for training purposes only. Oh, yeah, they need 1.6 billion bullets for training.
However, as we have documented, most of the bullets being purchased are hollow point rounds, which are almost twice as expensive as regular firing range bullets and therefore unsuitable for training purposes. As former Marine Richard Mason told reporters with WHPTV News in Pennsylvania early this month, "We've never trained with hollow points. We didn't even see hollow points my entire 4.5 years in the Marine Corps."
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's where we're at here, guys. It's pretty sick shit. It's pretty sick stuff. Hollow point ammo purchase. Ammo buy implodes. Government cover up of ammo buys implodes. Okay. Celebrities take. Okay. I wanted to next thing I wanted to go to was Uber, because I really hate this guy, all right, and everything he stands for, and you know, he's just this is a decent article on what he's done, trying to do. Washington Times actually.
He seems to want to get into every aspect of your life.
I mean, the guy is banned smoking in public. He's banned smoking everywhere. He's banning sugary drinks. He's banning everything that he possibly can.
He's very intrusive.
Oh, extreme. And now he's trying to get into the gun control laws and stuff. And he's a dictator. He's a damn dictator. And you know, and a megalomaniac.
And the name of this article is New York City Mayor Bloomberg, and his government has the right to infringe on your freedom. Whoop. Washington. There it is. New York City Michael Bloomberg said on Sunday, there's all kinds of things popping up in front of it.
They pop up everywhere on this page.
Okay.
Holy cow. All right.
Okay. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg said on Sunday, "Sometimes government does know best. In those cases, Americans should cede their rights. I do think there are certain times we should infringe on your freedom," Mr. Bloomberg said during an appearance in NBC. He made this statement during discussion of his soda ban, just shot down by the courts, an insistence that his fight to control sugary drink portion sizes in the city would go forth. "We think the judge was clearly wrong on this," he said on NBC. "Our Department of Health has the legal ability to do this, and they're not banning anything." Mr. Bloomberg's remaining months in office have included a firestorm of regulations and policy pushes on a wide range of issues. Aside from the soda size ban and the well-publicized call for tighter gun control, another contentious policy push, nudging hospitals to lock up baby formula to force mothers to breastfeed newborns.
Let's see. There's a little more down here. All right. And let me see if I can get this one. I'm curious what this is. Approaching Obama scandal.
Oh.
That's kind of really true or not. So, you're about to see, it's controversial, maybe offensive.
Well, they don't even tell you what you're about to see.
No, it's probably an answer.
The following presentation is controversial and may be offensive to some audiences. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hello, my name is Porter Stansberry. 14 years ago, I founded.
It's just an ad.
Okay, God, don't go to Washington Times. This thing is so loaded with pop-ups and everything. Unbelievable. How anybody travels to this thing? But anyway, let's get out of here.
He's said there was another audio piece that you had.
Yeah, I just got to, I don't know why.
Wait, you better wait.
Excuse me, folks, I'm trying to get this thing to, my computer to go here.
NYPD whistleblower suspended and sent to psychiatric ward. Oh, that's great. Great for being a whistleblower.
Yep.
Terrible things seem to happen to people that do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah. And this is in New York City police. So, like Serpico, remember Serpico?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, let's see what that's about. Something else. Oh, God. Oh, how about I hate this one. Sorry, folks. There are some websites that, you know, that are really loaded for bear. I mean, they got bugs in them, they got everything, and some of them are really bad. So, just hang on a second here. Really, really dislike these websites. There we go. Beggars in Newtown, Sandy Hook. You ready for this one?
The people being taken advantage of?
No idea. Let's see what this guy says.
Hey guys, so just a couple of quick news blurbs. One is a controversy going around about this video that Piers Morgan put up of Robbie Parker's daughter, Emily Parker, which there's already enough controversy surrounding her. I don't even know why they keep putting these two people in the news, Robbie and Alyssa Parker. They're crazy. But this is supposed to be Emily. And what they're wondering is why they're in red for a kindergarten graduation ceremony. A couple of things, Sandy Hook didn't have a kindergarten ceremony, so that rules that out. Second of all, there's a cross in the background here, and it looks to be a church setting. I am not affiliated with any religious organization, so I'm not sure what the protocol these days or what they do in churches with the kids. That's the first thing. Also, Sandy Hook's school colors are green and white. And then the second article I wanted to bring to you was the Connecticut Attorney General sees no basis for Newtown lawsuit. I'm going to just read it quick, and I'll leave the link up, but it says Connecticut's Attorney General says he sees no basis for lawsuits against the state of Newtown over the shooting deaths last December of 20 children and 6 educators. Attorney General George Jepson said in an interview on WFSB-TV's Face the State on Sunday that he believes there's no basis to sue Connecticut for anything it may have done. He also said he doesn't believe there's a reasonable basis to sue Newtown. A lawyer earlier this year withdrew a claim to sue the state for $100 million on behalf of a 6-year-old survivor of the December 14th school massacre. Irving Pinsky withdrew the lawsuit, but said he might refile. He said he is reviewing new evidence on the security at San Diego.
Rockefellers crown cocaine and Haitian slavery.
Oh, that poor country. Devastated. Those poor people, I feel so sorry for them.
They've been so
abused. An abused people. And we're, we have a big part of that.
And I like Veterans Today. I always have their veteranstoday.com.
Yep.
Their,
it's
the
pretty
editor,
forthright.
The editor there is he does immense words. And he had a lot of readers. Let's go up here. Come on. Trying to get this article up, folks, so bear with us for a second.
It's quite a while sometimes to get these articles to come up. They don't always come up very quickly.
Some of the reasons for that is there, I read that.
Here it is.
I read today that there's a massive attack on the internet. Hackers that are attacking the American internet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's slowing things down tremendously.
This is from Veterans Today. By Dean Henderson. With 2,100 people dead from cholera since the devastating January 2010 Haitian earthquake, and another 650,000 expected to contract the disease within the next 6 months, the last thing Haiti needed was another rigged election. but the nation's role as a wage floor for multinational corporations, combined with its geographic importance to the CIA, orchestrated Colombian cocaine trade, made the November 28, 2010 election fraud, which provoked fiery protests, all too predictable. The shortest route from Colombia's San Andreas Island to Miami passes through the island of Haiti, where Bank of Nova Scotia's subsidiary, Scotiabank, dominates finance. The Zionist Brofman family controlled Bank of Nova Scotia is the leading gold dealer in the cocaine-infested Caribbean Silver Triangle. It owned the 200 tons of gold recovered beneath the rubble of the World Trade Center in late 2001. Gold is the currency of choice in the British Crown-controlled global narcotics trade. From the 1970s until 1986, Haiti was ruled by Jean-Claude Papadoc and son Baby Doc Duvalier. The dictators were popped up by the U.S., which sent them over $400 million, which didn't end up in Duvalier pockets. What didn't end up in Duvalier pockets was used by U.S. corporations to set up factories to take advantage of super cheap Haitian labor. Haiti was a centerpiece of the Caribbean Basin Initiative, launched by David Rockefeller's International Basic Economy Corporation, which aimed to create a low-wage manufacturing platform in the Caribbean for its multinational corporate tentacles.
Real wages in Haiti declined 56% from 1983 to 1991 after the Caribbean Basin initiatives kicked in. Haitians' exports boomed with companies like Rawlings sending sweatshop-manufactured baseballs to the U.S. Dallas Oilmen and Intercontinental Hotels. Owner Clint Murchison operated meatpacking plants in Haiti, which he entrusted to the watchful eye of the later assassinated CIA agent, and Lee Harvey Oswald handler George de Morin Schultz. The devastated U.S. textile industry has been largely outsourced to Haiti. Nowhere in the world is labor cheaper. Baby Doc Duvalier fell after a popular revolt in 1986 and retired in the French Riviera alongside other U.S. tin cup dictators. That year, the CIA created the Haitian National Intelligence Service, or SIN, S-I-N. The acronym, which it shares with Peruvian intelligence, is likely a tongue-in-cheek MI6 Freemason joke. S-I-N was created under the guise of fighting drug trafficking, but its officials simply look over the Colombian coke transshipment trade from Duvalier's cronies, the Tonton Macoutes. Tonton Macoutes. Haitian gangs took over the drug trade in many U.S. cities.
Despite a U.S. congressional ban on aid to Haiti, SIN received $1 million a year from the CIA while the company set about training and equipping the new Haitian military. The CIA was trying to put a lid on the leftist revolution which swept Baby Doc from power, the Lavalas family movement. SIN set about on a reign of terror against the Haitian left, taking over where Duvalier's Tonton Macoutes left off. In 1989, the head of SIN, Colonel Ernesto Prudhomme, led a brutal interrogation of progressive Port-au-Prince mayor Evans Paul. Former SIN chief Leopold Sirjeun was also present. Mayor Paul came away with 5 broken ribs and serious internal injuries. A U.S. embassy official said of SIN, "It was a military organization that distributed drugs in Haiti. SIN never produced drug intelligence. The agency gave them money under counter-narcotics, and they used their training to do other things in the political area. One of those things was masterminding the coup that overthrew populist President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the Roman Catholic priest who won Haiti's first democratic election in 1991. Aristide was a leader of the Lavalas family movement. He preached liberation theology. the Catholic left turn that came out of the 1968 Medellin Vatican II conference, inspiring revolutions throughout Latin America. Aristide had earlier escaped the assassination attempts by Duvalier's Touton Marcus. Upon taking office, Aristide began arresting Sin officials involved in drug trafficking and raised the Haitian minimum wage from 22 cents an hour to 37 cents an hour. U.S. corporations groused and began a smear campaign against Aristide. USA came to their rescue, launching a $26.7 million U.S. taxpayer-funded assault on Aristide's minimum wage proposal and other progressive initiatives he had implemented.
I mean, 22 cents to 37 cents an hour, and they go after him?
Uh-huh.
Andre Appaid, a wealthy Haitian businessman, was handpicked by USAID to spearhead the anti-Aristide campaign via his export promotion firm. Prominex, a Permindex affiliate in Nazi International World Trade Center Global Drug Trafficking and Assassination Network. Permindex was behind both the JFK assassination and the attempt to assassinate French President Charles de Gaulle. It is run by MI6 and Israeli Mossad. Funding comes from wealthy European aristocrats. Appaid's company supplied numerous U.S. multinationals, including Honeywell, IBM, Remington, and Unisys. Meanwhile, CIA agents Brian Littell and James Woolsey, later Clinton's CIA director, marched out a report they wrote citing Aristide's mental health problems. Miami DEA chief Thomas Cash even tried unsuccessfully link Aristide to the Colombian cocaine business. In 1991, just months after Aristide took office, the groups that USAID funded led a military coup. A military junta headed by Army Chief Raul Cidras was installed, and Cidras was a CIA informant in charge of Haiti's military. SIN was renamed a FRAP, F-R-A-P-H, and embarked upon another bout of political terror against the Lavalas peasant groups and unions. Wages decreased further, and one apparel firm supplying U.S. contractors paying 14 cents an hour.
USA point man Andre Appaid definitely then got paid, becoming a Washington lobbyist for the Cidras regime. He told a crowd in Miami that if Aristide returns to Haiti, I'd strangle him. But it was FRAP that was doing the bulk of the strangling. Amnesty International reported 2,000 civilians murdered in Haiti within 18 months of the Cidras coup. CIA agent Brian Littell, whose phony report helped topple Aristide, visited Haiti in 1992. He praised Cidras and said he saw no evidence of oppressive rule or mass killings. Amnesty International called his assessment absurd.
Aristide went into exile in the U.S.
No, he didn't go into... Oh, he did.
He said in the U.S., but I didn't think they did.
I thought he went to Africa.
Yeah, I did too. Let's see what he said. Aristide went into exile in the U.S. He eventually cut a deal with the World Bank, which allowed him to return to Haiti. The deal involved leaving FRAF members in government, privatizing 300 state-owned companies, slashing Haiti's tariffs, and important. I mean, he sold out.
Huh?
And rewriting Haiti's corporate tax laws. Aristide Lavalias' family movement was banned from politics and wages would be frozen at the rate of 11 cents an hour. 11 to 18 cents an hour, lower than under the Duvalier dictatorship. Haiti was to establish a World Bank price floor for wages in the Western Hemisphere. Once the deal was cut, President Clinton intervened in Haiti to bring Aristide back. What a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
In 1993, the U.S. Harlan County sailed into Port-au-Prince to lay the groundwork for Aristide's return. The ship was met by violent demonstrators led by Emmanuel Toto Constant, who was a CIA payroll, was on the CIA payroll as founder and head of the murderous FRAF. Toto attended Clinton's inaugural ball, and his father, General Constant was Papa's Doc's Army Chief of Staff. Oh, my God. It gets filthier and filthier and filthier and filthier. And we're out of time. But if you want to go to this article, I suggest you do. Read a little more about the reality of Haiti. Go to veteranstoday.com.
It's a sad article. It really is.
Rockefeller's crown, cocaine, and Haiti slavery. I've always felt bad for it. And I mean, you know, what I don't understand is what is happening there. Nothing at all has happened. People are still homeless over there. You know, and all the millions and millions of dollars that that the Americans people, the actual American people, donated, is gone. I mean, it hasn't been spent. It went into the pockets of the Clintons and the Clinton groups and the USAID and the CIAs and everybody else.
Very sad.
And it's just a sick situation.
Well, on that unhappy note, folks, I'm sorry we couldn't leave you with a more uplifting report, but you ought to read that about Haiti. It's very, very sad.
VeteransToday.com.
Okay.
So, good night, everybody.
Good night, folks, and have a good evening.
Thank you.